one is consideration of our reality. Actually, what the Mayavadins call the illusion, from thinking of that as a dream experience to thinking of that as a hallucination. And he has foregrounded these two analogies at the outset, because these are the analogies that have been made by illusionistic schools. The dream experience is something which has been talked about within some of the illusionistic Indian schools as well as some of the Chinese schools. And he's trying to probe in that section. Sri Aurobindo probes the nature of dream and establishes that dream, in fact, is not really illusionistic. It has some kind of meaning structure to it, that images and symbols are being experienced, a transcript of some kind of record, either of the external world or of some internal world is being experienced through dreams. If that is the case, then to argue that an illusionistic experience or of reality is something like a dream becomes a bad analogy or a wrong analogy, and so he discards it. That's the argument he has taken so far. And now he moves to the other argument of illusion being like a hallucination. That argument is also made in some of the Mayavadin schools like Advaita Vedanta. And we find that he raises two kinds of possibilities of hallucination here. One of which he calls a visual hallucination, and the other a mental hallucination. A visual hallucination is one where we have, he says, something like a mirage. Something that doesn't exactly exist, but which our eyes feel exists or see as existing. The mental hallucination is like a projection where we see something that actually exists, but mistaken for something else. He gives the example of a mirage as a visual hallucination. And the often repeated trope used by Shankara of a rope imagined to be a snake as a kind of mental hallucination. So here he begins probing the nature of hallucination of both these kinds, and he comes up with a problem right in the beginning, which is that in both these cases, it isn't something non-existent that we are seeing as a hallucination. It is something that is either a memory image in the mind of something seen earlier or something seen elsewhere that is being seen again erroneously. So it may be an error of the mind, but it is not an illusion that is being projected. This is a more appropriate analogy could only be thought of if indeed, there was a compatibility of types. In other words, if indeed reality was an illusion, then illusory objects were being projected on it, not something out of a real. So that if there is a seeing of a real, that must be coming out of reality. It couldn't be coming out of an illusion. So that is where this particular argument stands, where we are at present. And if anybody would like to comment or question, we could consider it or could move on to the next paragraph in this analogy.
Margaret, would you like to start reading?
Just a sec. Just one second. It is clear that in this analogy, two quite different kinds of illusion, not illustrated of each other, are mistakenly put together as if they were identical in nature. All mental or sense hallucinations are really misrepresentations or misplacements or impossible combinations or false developments of things that are in themselves existing or possible or in some way within or allied to the province of the real. All mental errors and illusions are the result of an ignorance which miscombines its data or proceeds falsely upon a previous or present or possible content of knowledge. But the cosmic illusion has no basis of actuality. It is an original and all-originating illusion. It imposes names, figures, happenings that are pure inventions on a reality in which there never were and never will be any happenings, names, or figures. The analogy of mental hallucination would only be applicable if we admit a Brahman without names, forms, or relations, and a world of names, forms, and relations as equal realities imposed one upon the other. The rope in the place of the snake, or the snake in the place of the rope. An attribution, it might be, of the activities of the saguna to the quiescence of the nirguna. But if both are real, both must be either separate aspects of the reality or coordinate aspects, positive and negative poles of the one existence. Any error or confusion of mind between them would not be a creative cosmic illusion, but only a wrong perception of realities, a wrong relation created by the ignorance.
So here is where he points out that there is an incompatibility of types, that these examples are all taken from some kind of reality and seeing a hallucination, or something which is not that reality but something else, as he says, a miscombination of data or false proceeding, etc. There are various misplacements, misrepresentations, impossible combinations of false developments. But the argument of the Advaitins is that the cosmic illusion has no basis of actuality. So that's why it's that sentence. But the cosmic illusion has no basis of actuality. It is an original and not originating illusion. That is not his sentence. It's something he usually does, where he takes the position of the school that he is interrogating, which in this case is the Advaitin school. And so he's saying that's what they believe, that it imposes names, figures, happenings that are pure inventions on a reality in which there never were and never will be any happenings, names, or figures. So this is the more appropriate way of looking at it from their point of view, which hallucinations don't really match. So he's saying that this would have worked if, on the one hand, we gave equal right to the real and the unreal. And he says that in terms of philosophy, the saguna and the nirguna were, you know, either one of them was real and the other was unreal. But if both are real, both must be either separate aspects of the reality or coordinate aspects. So as in the case of hallucination, we are actually talking about reality which is being projected onto another reality, maybe a confusion of a reality by some organ such as the mind, but nevertheless something that has real existence being projected on something that has real existence. And if that is the case, then both must be real, and either separate aspects of the reality or coordinate aspects, positive and negative poles of the one existence. So in other words, they must be related. They must be, in a sense, two ways in which something which is transcendent makes itself manifest. A complementarity of manifestation. And then if there is any error or confusion of mind, it would not be a creative cosmic illusion, but a wrong perception of realities, a wrong relation created by the ignorance. So the argument of hallucination is something that he is attributing more properly to a false organ of the ignorance, the mind, say for example, but not so false perception rather than unreality being projected upon reality.
Justin, would you like to read next?
Certainly. Give me 1 second. If we scrutinize other illustrations or analogies that are offered to us for a better understanding of the operation of Maya, we detect in them, in all of them, an applicability that deprives them of their force and value. The familiar instance of mother of pearl and silver turns also, like the rope and snake analogy, upon an error due to a resemblance between a present real and another, an absent real. It can have no application to the imposition of a multiple and mutable unreality upon a sole and unique immutable real. In the example of an optical illusion duplicating or multiplying a single object, as when we see two moons instead of one, there are two or more identical forms of the same object. The one, the real one, or the rest, an illusion. This does not illustrate the juxtaposition of world and Brahman, for in the operation of Maya, there is a much more complex phenomenon. There is indeed
an illusory multiplication of the identical imposed upon its one and ever unalterable identity, the one appearing as many, but upon that is imposed an immense organized diversity in nature, a diversity of forms and movements which have nothing to do with the original real. Dreams, visions, the imagination of the artist or poet can present such an organized diversity which is not real, but is an imitation, a mimesis of the real and already existent organized diversity, or it starts from such a mimesis, and even in the richest variation or wildest invention, some mimetic element is observable. There is here no such thing as the operation attributed to Maya, in which there is no mimesis, but a pure and radically original creation of unreal forms and movements that are non-existent anywhere, and neither imitate nor reflect nor alter and develop anything discoverable in the reality. There is nothing in the operations of mind illusion that throws light upon this mystery. And I said love, yes. It is a stupendous cosmic illusion of this kind that must be sui generis without parallel. What we see in the universe is that a diversity of the identical is everywhere the fundamental operation of cosmic nature. But here it presents itself not as an illusion, but as a various real formation out of a one original substance, a reality of oneness, manifesting itself in a reality of numberless forms and powers of its being is what we confront everywhere. There is no doubt in its process a mystery, even a magic. But there is nothing to show that it is a magic of the unreal and not a working of a consciousness and a force and force of being of the omnipotent real, a self-creation operated by an eternal self-knowledge.
So here he's extending that idea of the two kinds of hallucination, of the two examples that he has taken of optical and mental hallucination and its instances. And he's trying to see if the same kind of problem can exist in other cases. And he sees other illustrations. In one case, he sees an illustration similar to the rope and snake analogy, which is mistaking mother of pearl for silver. So it's one substance which looks like another substance. So there is a kind of mimetic quality or quality of something which is imitating something else. This may also be seen in the case of camouflage, or both in artificial as well as in natural evolutionary camouflage. Something seems to mimic something else, but both these things, I mean, whatever is being mimicked is real, and it isn't as if there is something unreal that is being presented over here. So that is what he draws attention to over there, that this has no, can have no application to the imposition of a multiple and mutable unreality upon a sole and unique immutable real, which is the argument of the Mayavadins, the illusionists. Then he talks about another kind of optical illusion, where we see multiple copies of the same. We see two moons instead of one, or two or more identical forms of one object. One of them only is real, and the other, or the rest, are illusory. But this again does not quite illustrate the juxtaposition of world and Brahman, because we find that there too, there's an original and a copy. While in the case of the idea of Brahman and illusory projection upon Brahman, unreal projection upon Brahman, there is again one ever unalterable identity. And we may say that the one has appeared as many, if we take that same analogy of the moon, but that many is actually not identical, but as he says over here, an immense organized diversity in nature, a diversity of forms and movements which have nothing to do with the original real. So, I mean, if we talk about the two being totally different, we have to assume that, you know, that there is a complete incompatibility between the reality of Brahman and this, you know, this ordered multiplicity of the of nature or of the universe. But as we see, this kind of ordered multiplicity is something which tells us, gives us a hint of some repetition of the original that is manifesting its infinite possibilities. In fact, this seems to be the very nature of the intuition with which we approach the world. It's interesting that this particular part of this paragraph is very close to the central argument of one of the books by Gilles Deleuze called Difference and Repetition, which is exactly about this, that the one is repeating itself, but it never repeats itself exactly. It repeats itself through variation. And this enormous diversity that we see is itself the ever recurrence of the same as its own infinite possibility. So here we can, this is so obvious an intuition that it seems almost artificial to think that this is an unreal diversity that has manifested out of nowhere on something which is real. And Sri Aurobindo talks about, compares this condition to things like dreams, visions, and imaginations. It says that there too we may have this kind of a organized diversity, and the organized diversity is not real. But then, as he says, in all these cases, that organized diversity is based on nature itself. It may be a contortion or distortion of nature. It may be a tremendous extension of whatever exists and includes whatever does not yet exist, or whatever does not exist here. But nevertheless, the fact of mimesis remains. There are copies of things that already exist that are being developed in all these mental phenomena. There is no such thing as the operation attributed to Maya, in which there is no mimesis, but a pure and radically original creation of unreal forms and movements that are non-existent anywhere, and neither imitate, nor reflect, nor alter and develop anything discoverable in the reality. So this is not a good analogy, whether we take it as these kinds of, you know, sort of objects that are mistaken for other objects, or optical illusions, multiplications, or these mental phenomena. In all these cases, the analogy doesn't quite work, because in all these cases, we are working with something which is being created out of something already real, something that exists. So then from this, he moves to this comparison which I just mentioned, the obvious intuition of this diversity being a self-multiplication of the one in its infinite variations. So that's what he says. What we see in the universe is that a diversity of the identical is everywhere the fundamental operation of cosmic nature. But here it presents itself not as an illusion, but as a various real formation out of one original substance, a reality of oneness manifesting itself in a reality of numberless forms and powers of its being is what we confront everywhere. There is no doubt in its process a mystery, even a magic. How is this presenting itself? That is where we are stumped, because the immutable oneness of the Brahma manifesting as its infinite variant possibilities, arrayed as it were in grades, a graduated kind of manifestation, implies some type of mechanism which eludes us. We don't know what that mechanism is. Indeed, that is the mechanism of Maya. And that mechanism of Maya is something that seems magical to us, but it doesn't mean that it is the operation of an unreal or the presentation of an unreal upon a real. So that's why he says, there is no doubt in this process of mystery, even a magic, but there is nothing to show that it is a magic of the unreal and not a working of the consciousness and force of being of the omnipotent real, a self-creation operated by an eternal self-knowledge. So it is a manifestation, a self-creation, as they say, swayambhu, a self-appearance by a power of self-knowledge. I see myself and I become what I see in myself, as Sri Aurobindo says. So that is very different from the argument that something unreal is being projected on the real, which doesn't make sense either to our experience at any level, whether as dream, hallucination, optical illusion, or optical multiplication, or as something which we can imagine as being possible.
Can I make a comment?
Yes, please.
That is, you know, this reminds me of life itself. For example, if I think of an individual as, you know, as the immutable, in the sense that it is the same, it is the identical, yet it sees its copy at different points of time. And, you know, basically the life principle, which kind of goes from one moment of time to another moment of time. I mean, of course, not only life of an individual, life of the whole universe also. So that, I think it's easier for us to experience this becoming, this variation, which is possible by this cosmic nature, out of that immutable one.
If you think of the life principle as a becoming in time.
Right, in time.
Right.
So here
you see the continuity of the variation that is manifesting.
Right. And here it is like there is another dimension, that is space.
Yes.
Which is not this exactly the same, but
yes,
I'm just saying
it seems to be more discrete there.
Yeah.
But it's also a discrete distribution of infinite variation of the same. Quite cool.
would like to please offer. Is there any way of distinguishing if between? Well, I mean, I'll offer the terms from the Yoga Sutra again. Between Samyoga, which would be a false sort of process of misconstruing the seer and the seen, and something like Samapatti, which would be a coincidence, a creative coincidence of seer and seen, or of different, actually, of what is grasped and of what is grasping. Is there some way of comparing between the sort of these illusory experiences where there's an unconsciousness about who is seeing and what is being seen in this process, as opposed to perhaps a very creative, conscious, artistic bringing together, a coincidence of these different elements in one place that makes a creative experience?
Yes, Justin. So I think what you're talking about is also what, you know, both the instances that you're marshalling from the Yoga Sutras have to do with operations of consciousness. And they have to do with misconstrual or with creative, you know, envisioning of the real, you know. And this is exactly the point that he's making, that in all these cases, either you can have misconstruction, which is happening due to error of perception, error of consciousness, error of identity, or you may have the imagination, as he's saying, operating at a very high level, or the intuition, which can fill in the gaps, as it were, and see possibilities that are not manifest in front of us, but which belong to the One, nevertheless, because it's part of that infinite variation of the One and the perception of the One. So both are possibilities. One is an infra-rational possibility, and the other is a supra-rational possibility. But in both cases, it is the real that is being seen. In one case is a distorted real, the other case is a future real, you may say. A virtual real. The Yoga Sutra, for that matter, is actually an empirical text, and it doesn't say anything about unreality. It's not talking about illusion. What it's talking about is misperception or higher perception.
Devashish, when Srilabindo was writing these chapters, or when they were being read, did anyone from the Mayavadin or Vedantic schools, I mean, I haven't read all the letters, but did anyone ever sort of dialogue with Srilabindo about his taking on these ideas from Mayavadin or Vedantic and saying that they were not an appropriate analogy? Is there any record of sort of a dialogue from both camps?
That's an interesting question. I'm not fully aware of the answer to that question. Maybe somebody in the archives might know. But I know this, that even while Sri Aurobindo was writing this, people who were reading it included people who were Advaitins and Mayavadins, some of whom, you know, agreed with him and became his disciples later. And at the same time, there were, even while he was writing this, a number of people who would not accept it and continued to, in the academic world as well as in the world of yoga, continued to hold to Advaitin position. Now, the ones who, and since Sri Aurobindo has left the body, it's interesting to know that in the academy, there is actually a resurgence of the Advaitic standpoint. Also, partly due to the, the kind of support given to it by the Hindu right. See, the Advaita Vedanta became actually the foundation of what has been called the Vishwa Hindu Parishad. And there is a two-way commerce there between the Hindu political right and the Advaita Vedantin establishment, which is natural, actually, because the reason, the strength that it gets is from claiming that there has to be one reality and one answer to reality, a rational answer to reality. We cannot have diversity which is incompatible, which cannot actually be coherently organized in terms of the infinity of Brahman. So when they want to do that, essentially they claim that there is, that can only be done if the Brahman is formless, and whatever world of forms we perceive is a provisional or empirical world of forms that essentially turn illusory when we have the realization of Brahman. You see, so that kind of argument is still quite prevalent, because it seems to satisfy a more simplistic kind of demand of a mind which seeks for one epistemology, one theory of knowledge. See, a theory of knowledge which is, kind of ideologically uniform.
Thank you,
The difficulty of what Sri Aurobindo is saying is this, that infinite variation is the way by which the One expresses its infinite truths. And if we are going to look for the One, there's evidently a gap between this infinite experience and the One. And that gap is not negotiable by the mind. Either you have the One or the Many. It is only, this is exactly why Sri Aurobindo is saying, the convergence of the Many and the One occur beyond the mind. It occurs in another organ in which the two can coexist, as he says, that term he uses over there, something. Coordinate aspects. They are the One. The One has no problem with its own infinity, but we have a problem with its infinity because the human mind thinks in finites, thinks discretely.
In fact, I was trying to contemplate on the fact that what if something that is conscious and yet it has no variation. I just realized that it is actually difficult for the mind to comprehend, because it kind of gets lost into something inexpressible or something not even perceivable. Do you agree?
Yeah.
Variation is almost like an essential
feature of consciousness.
Feature of consciousness in order for us to perceive with our faculties.
Right. This is one of the, kind of like the problem, again, going back to the problem of Advaita Vedanta, the sort of paradox of trying to think, where we are using the mind as a tool, and the enterprise of philosophy, if it is subject to the mind, because it is a thinking process, it naturally subjects the infinite to the law of the mind. And so if we think that it is possible to do that, or it must be so, the infinite must subject itself to the law of mind, then it is fine, then it works. But as soon as we challenge that, it doesn't work anymore.
What is it?
I mean, this idea of that there is only a formless one and everything else is illusion, that appears, and only when we go beyond that, we meet the one. Either there is the one or there is the many. That kind of mental.
I think it's one of the could be justification in doing so is that the division is not independent of the unity, in the sense that this variation is not something which can be independently true without taking that one reality. So that's why logically, if you say, oh, okay, something is derived from something else. So it's like the derived one is just a consequence of that. It's not really real that way.
Yeah.
It's like it is a perception of the one in the that way. Which is also probably true. It's just that we tend to because I've seen whenever even talking about quantum reality, etc. There people tend to feel, when we observe, it collapses. So that means we are the one who create the reality. So it means that it is, in a way, illusion, abstract. It's not really, if we don't observe, it doesn't exist. So when the thing is, I think it is coming from that kind of,
Derivative
of that kind of thinking.
Yeah, derivative idea in the sense that the many are dependent on the one. The many are the self-manifestations of the infinity of the one. Now, of course, the idea of the supermind challenges that to some extent as well, because it's saying that the infinite and the one are both equal realities. I mean, they're properties of the same real, the properties of the real.
But which is a primary variation. I'm not talking about many.
We're talking about infinite variation
in the sense where there is a separation.
The identical has been
So can it challenge? I mean, the identity
no.
and the variation are equal.
No, I don't think they're challenging that. What they're saying is that there's one reality in which the infinity is in the front, but it is the infinity of the one. Another in
yes,
which
but
the
infinity
one is,
of the one.
Yeah.
If you take out the one, that
there is
then
only
the whole
one.
Thing vanishes.
Yeah. No, all the schools, including what Sri Aurobindo is saying, is that there is only.
That's right. So basically,
but our experience of the one's experience of itself. Is not, whenever we say one, we seem to think of one as being different from many.
Mm.
But that is not the case in supermind.
Right.
Yeah. So it's difficult to say that the one predominates, but the many are secondary to it.
Right. And also, like, in our mental world, like in the objective world, like, we know that only one thing, I mean, when we see multiple images, like duplication, we know that only one is real and the all else are the images. But that is not quite the same logic in terms of this reality, consciousness. Where actually one can actually be many, you know. That is something I think logically somewhere we don't
comprehend. That's partly the reason why it's simpler to kind of think and reduce it to a perfect.
John Robert, would you like to read next?
Yes, happy to. This at once raises the question of the nature of mind, the parent of these illusions, and its relation to the original existence. Is mind the child and instrument of an original illusion? Or is it itself a primal miscreating force or consciousness? Or is the mental ignorance a misprision of the truths of existence, a deviation from an original truth consciousness, which is the real world builder? Our own mind, at any rate, is not an original and primary creative power of consciousness. It is, and all mind of the same character must be, derivative, an instrumental demiurge, an intermediary creator. It is likely then that analogies from the errors of the mind, which are the outcome of an intermediate ignorance, may not truly illustrate the nature or action of an original creative illusion, or an all-inventing and all-constructing Maya. Our mind stands between a superconscience and an inconscience, and receives from both these opposite powers. It stands between an occult subliminal existence and an outward cosmic phenomenon. It receives inspirations, intuitions, imaginations, impulsions to knowledge and action, figures of subjective realities or possibilities from the unknown inner source. It receives the figures of realized actualities and their suggestions of further possibility from the observed cosmic phenomenon. What it receives are truths essential, possible, or actual. It starts from the realized actualities of the physical universe, and it brings out from them, in its subjective action, the unrealized possibilities which they contain, or suggest, or to which it can arrive by proceeding from them as a starting point. It selects some out of these possibilities for a subjective action and plays with imagined or inwardly constructed forms of them. It chooses others for objectivization and attempts to realize them. But it receives inspirations also from above and within, from invisible sources, and not only from the impacts of the visible cosmic phenomenon. It sees truths other than those suggested by the actual physicality around it,
and here too it plays subjectively with transmitted or constructive forms of these truths, or it selects for objectivization, attempts to realize.
So the trend of this paragraph emerges from what we have been discussing so far, where it is clear that, particularly towards the end of the last paragraph, he's talking about the errors that are introduced by the mind. We just discussed this, that the mind can either distort reality or project something unreal, or not unreal, project something from the memory onto from some other reality onto this reality. And out of that comes our sense, our ability to make a comparison between mental phenomena and the possibility that the world is an illusion. So he's taking up this argument over here that maybe it is due to the nature of the mind that we can arrive at this kind of a argument that the cosmic illusion exists, because it is a kind of mental phenomenon, like maybe some kind of universal mind phenomenon which is like the human mind. And that's why he asks this question about the nature of mind and what is its relationship with Maya, for that matter. Is it itself a creation, a creator, an original creator? It is similar to the question you brought up, or the idea you brought up, of mind actually, our individual mind creating reality or its impossibility. So is it that? Is it doing that? Or is it some kind of derivative power? Is it a derivative to what? Is it the derivative of some kind of illusion-making power? Or is it a deviation from something original, that it is not something else, but it is functioning in a kind of distorted way, based on something? And here he's looking strictly at the human mind, and he's divesting those two possibilities of its being some original creator, on the one hand, and on the other hand, of its being a permanent operation of some kind of, Maya. Instead, what he's pointing out is that it occupies an intermediate position in a range of possible operations of consciousness. And in this intermediate position, it is taking both from inner realities and outer realities and trying to piece together an understanding. So what we have is, as they say, the whole enterprise of epistemology moves between empiricism and idealism, because the mind is drawing from these two poles. On the one hand, there is the pole of abstract ideas, which connect it to both inward realities as well as to higher realities, which gives some sort of truths of being. And on the other hand, you have empirical realities, which is nature and all the forms and the heuristics, the rules of thumb, which we derive from our experience, everyday experience, sense experience. So from these two poles, the mind is piecing together its reality, it's bringing out possibilities, it's bringing out the latent, hidden truths that are present in nature, or it is affirming certain kinds of ideas that it cannot see in, or cannot perceive in nature, and trying to realize them in the world. So this intermediate operation of something which is perhaps of another nature, a derivative, something which is of another nature, but we don't know what that is like, is occurring due to its enmeshment in ignorance. There is something which it is ignorant and yet trying to arrive at knowledge. And that is giving it this kind of operation. It can never be sure of anything, but it can keep pulling from two ends, from an end of intuitions and ideas and an end of perceptions and nature. Again, as he's going to point out, that firstly, it is dependent on something greater. You cannot impute to Maya the same principles that belong to mind. If anything, you can impute to mind the principles that belong to Maya. But you cannot go the other way, because mind is a derivative reality operating under specific conditions, which are the conditions of ignorance. And secondly, it is a ignorant reality or ignorant faculty which is drawing from real sources, both the source of nature, which is reality as it conceives it, as it sees it, and the source of ideas and subliminal kind of ranges, which are realities that it is in contact with inwardly. In both cases, it isn't an illusion that is being projected, but different ranges of reality that are being wrongly construed because of the nature of ignorance which belongs to the mind.
Ananda, would you like to read next?
Sure. Our mind is an observer and user of actualities, a diviner or recipient of truths not yet known or actualized, a dealer in possibilities that mediate between the truth and actuality. But it has not the omniscience of an infinite consciousness. It is limited in knowledge and has to supplement its restricted knowledge by imagination and discovery. It does not, like the infinite consciousness, manifest the known. It has to discover the unknown. It seizes the possibilities of the infinite, not as results or variations of forms of a latent truth, but as constructions or creations, figments of its own boundless imagination. It has not the omnipotence of an infinite conscious energy. It can only realize or actualize what the cosmic energy will accept from it, or what it has the strength to impose or introduce into the sum of things, because the secret divinity, superconscient or subliminal, which uses it intends that should be expressed in nature. Its limitation of knowledge constitutes by incompleteness, but also by openness to error and ignorance. In dealing with actualities, it may misobserve, misuse, miscreate. In dealing with possibilities, it may miscompose, miscombine, misapply, misplace. In its dealing with truths revealed to it, it may deform, misrepresent, disharmonize. It may also make constructions of its own which has no correspondence with the things of actual existence, no potentiality of realization, no support from the truth behind them. But still these constructions start from an illegitimate extension of actualities, catch at unpermitted possibilities, or turn truths to an application which is not applicable. Mind creates, but it is not an original creator, not omniscient or omnipotent, not even an always efficient demiurge. Maya, the elusive power, on the contrary, must be an original creator, for it creates all things out of nothing, unless we suppose that it creates out of the substance of the reality, but then the things it creates must be in some way real. It has a perfect knowledge of what it wishes to create, a perfect power to create whatever it chooses, omniscient and omnipotent, though only over its own illusions, harmonizing them and linking them together with a magical sureness and sovereign energy, absolutely effective in imposing its own formations or figments passed off as truths, possibility, actualities on the creature intelligence.
So here again we find that he is distancing the operations of mind from the operations of Maya. And he is doing this particularly by drawing attention to the finiteness of mind, that mind is a derivative creator, and it is marked by its ignorance and its finiteness. It is not infinite. It is not omnipotent. It is not omniscient. It is using discrete scraps of knowledge or of perception to piece together a reality for itself. And in that process, it can make many kinds of mistakes. And Sri Aurobindo goes through this very careful, almost like a classification of errors of the mind. Each one of them is extremely telling. If one pores over them or thinks about them, one finds that his litany to these errors of the mind are remarkably accurate and complete. Each one of them represents a specific kind of error. So he goes through that, and then he points out that in all these cases, it is still creating, but it is not an original creator. It's creating out of things that already exist. It is creating out of realities that are realities to it. So again, there is a distancing. We see that that is not the nature of Maya. Maya, if we classify it in the Advaitin sense, is, in any case, even if we don't classify it in the Advaitin sense, it is an original and hence an infinite creator. In the Advaitin sense, apart from being an infinite creator, it is a purely original creator because it does not draw on anything for its creations. It is creating out of nothing, as he points out. Maya, the elusive power, on the contrary, must be an original creator, for it creates all things out of nothing, unless we suppose that it creates out of the substance of the reality. So, there's a tongue-in-cheek quality to that sentence. When he says, it's an original creator, for it creates all things out of nothing. We can sense a tongue-in-cheek little sarcasm in Sri Aurobindo's sentence there. Because how can one create something out of nothing? That becomes one of the big philosophical conundrums. And so he's pointing to the other side and saying that unless we suppose that it creates out of the substance of the reality. So this is, it is the real manifesting its own possibilities through its creative power. But then, if that is the case, the things it creates must be in some way real. So again, he goes back to that point that we have to distance itself from the errors of the mind. It has to be something infinite and original. But if it is creating out of nothing, then of course there is nothing to say. It's totally something which is, you know, manifesting without root. But if we suppose that it is the original substance that is manifesting its own powers, then there is a real out of which Maya is creating, not an illusion or an illusory reality or an illusion. Then we have to say it must be in some way real. It has a perfect knowledge of what it wishes to create, perfect power to create whatever it chooses, omniscient and omnipotent, though only over its own illusions. Again, going back to the idea that maybe it is creating these illusions, but still it has to be omnipotent and omniscient, harmonizing them and linking them together with a magical sureness and sovereign energy, absolutely effective in imposing its own formations, or figments passed off as truths, possibilities, actualities, on the creature intelligence. So this is the fundamental difference between mind as a creator and Maya as a creator. Mind creates in an unsure manner out of a reality which it doesn't have a sure grasp on, that it is deforming even its perceptions or understandings. And also it creates as a finite creator because it doesn't have a grasp of everything. It only has a grasp of the little something that it has some sort of apprehension of. On the other hand, whatever is projecting this cosmos is a infinite creator, omniscient and omnipotent. If we are to take it that it is creating out of nothing, then only out of its illusions, but still it is omnipotent and omniscient regarding its illusions, and it is much more real or possible to think of it as creating out of an original substance, which is reality itself.
Matteo, would you like to read next?
Yes. Our mind works best and with a firm confidence when it is given a substance to work on, or at least to use as a basis for its operations. or when it can handle a cosmic force of which it has acquired the knowledge. It is sure of its steps when it has to deal with actualities. This rule of dealing with objectivized or discovered actualities and proceeding from them for creation is the reason of the enormous success of physical science. But here there is evidently no creation of illusions, no creation of non-existence in vacuo, and turning them into apparent actualities, such as is attributed to the cosmic illusion. For mind can only create out of substance what is possible to the substance. It can only do with the force of nature what is in accordance with her realizable energies. It can only invent or discover what is already contained in the truth and potentiality of nature. On the other side, it receives inspirations for creation from within itself or from above. But these can only take form if they are truths or potentials, not by the mind's own right of invention. For if the mind erects what is neither true nor potential, what cannot be created cannot become actual in nature. Maya, on the contrary, if it creates on the basis of the reality, yet erects a superstructure which has nothing to do with the reality, is not true or potential in it. If it creates out of the substance of reality, it makes out of it things that are not possible to it or in accordance with it. For it creates forms, and the reality is supposed to be a formless, incapable of form. It creates determinations, and the reality is supposed to be absolutely indeterminable.
Here, on the other hand, he's bringing the two a little closer. And here he's bringing them closer by talking about the substance necessary for creation and pointing to how the mind creates. If we are to take the analogy between mind and Maya, on the one hand, we have to think about the extent of the power. In the case of mind, it is a finite perception, a finite comprehension, finite apprehension. In the case of Maya, we find an infinite scope or scale. But if we think about the operation of these faculties, we see that mind operates on some kind of substance that it uses as a basis of its operation. Either a cosmic force or some kind of cosmic substance. And the more materialized or objectified these things are, the more successful it is. So he points to the enormous success of physical science as a result. But even in the case of its mental constructions, saying that there is no creation of illusions, it is only possible to create the possibilities or potentialities that are already present in whatever it is drawing from. It's drawing from something which has laws and only produces the possibilities of those laws, whether in the ideal or in the actual. So again, he goes back to Maya, and he's talking about, again, the illusionistic school, to which he has added the possibility that it may be creating out of a reality, but it is creating unreal things, things which don't have any law to them. So he says, Maya, on the contrary, if it creates on the basis of the reality, even if it does that, yet erects a superstructure which has nothing to do with the reality. So this is again a tongue-in-cheek comment on Advaita's illusionism, that if the world is completely illusory, it can't have any relation with the real. There can be nothing in it that derives from the real. So even though it seems as if there are many laws, etc., that hold this cosmos together, according to the illusionists, this superstructure has nothing to do with the reality. It is not true or potential. The real is not true or potential in it. If it creates out of the substance of the reality, it makes of it things that are not possible to it or in accordance with it, the it here being the real. This is a big paradox, you see. It's a tongue-in-cheek treatment. It's trying to say that if it is creating out, otherwise it's creating out of nothing. If it is creating out of something, then it must have no relation with what it's creating out of. That itself is again another paradox that he's bringing out. A paradox that is not present in the mind, because the mind only brings out the possibilities of the substance from which it creates. So again, he's trying to point out that this theory of Maya is something extremely paradoxical, doesn't lend itself to any kind of experience that we can affirm. If it creates forms and the reality is supposed to be a formless, incapable of form, it creates determinations. The reality is supposed to be absolutely indeterminable. So this is the other one that said the same thing about the superstructure. Where do all these relations come from? Why is there these variations that have a certain kind of graded and phased manifestation? Why are there laws to the cosmos? If you are going to say that there is only a reality which has no determinations, which is completely indeterminable, and which doesn't lend itself to any manifestation, then where is the relationship between the two? This is a paradox.
Devashish, do we have in the West theories of Maya or theories that are similar to Maya with the same kind of power and grip of popularity that he's arguing against in the Indian tradition?
Well, in the West, what you do have are, say, for example, Plato's theory, which is one of, the world being a world of shadows. It's sort of the Platonic idea of the cave with the shadows, and the people whose head is turned to the wall and see the shadows thrown on the wall and taking that for the real. But, calling it an illusion is something that is not something that you can construe it as an illusion. Shadows can be thought of as illusions, but these illusions are nevertheless phenomena that are being produced from reals. The sun is throwing its light on things and producing shadows. But nevertheless, it's a secondary reality, and that's where he brings in this whole notion of mimesis. In other words, nature is a fall from the world of true ideas. and is a bad copy of, just like shadows are a bad copy of a world of reality, and we are stuck in that. And if we try to mimic that, we create even with the mind. In other words, just like she's talking about the mind, it's like saying that Maya has already created a bad copy, and the mind makes even worse copies. So this is the Platonic way of, you know, transmitting a similar idea. But it doesn't certainly make a very, you know, sort of kind of big metaphysically argued case for it, except to say that we have to find the light outside this, you know, the world of ideas or whatever, and then there are ways by which one can get out of this appearance which is false. Now, the idea that the appearance is false, the cosmos presents a false appearance, is not something that Sri Aurobindo is warring against. He accepts that. And in fact, that is part of the Vedantic truth. What he is warring against is to take this cosmos as unreal, to take the fact that the cosmos is a kind of projection of an unreality upon the reality of Brahman. The reason he's doing that is that then the cosmos is irredeemable. The only solution we have is an escape. Does the West also sort of hold that as the solution? It's difficult to tell. If you take Plato's case, on the one hand, of course, there is always in Western philosophy a certain kind of attempt to arrive at social perfectibility. So Plato writes The Republic, where he's trying to create a perfect society. But if we take his parable of the cave, one may also say that this deepest teaching that Plato, which the Neoplatonists are trying to affirm, is something similar to the illusionism of Advaita Vedanta. So let's escape from the cave. We are imprisoned in the cave. The cave is a cave of delusions. And it's only if we get out of the cave that we can arrive at truth. So let's escape out of the cave. So Neoplatonism sort of moves in that direction, the direction of affirming a kind of pristine, formless reality, which has been distorted. They wouldn't go as far as saying it's an illusion, but they would move in a kind of escapist direction, I would say. But as I said, Plato at the same time does affirm the possibility of social perfectibility. And this has been part of the journey of Western metaphysics, you know, in trying to arrive at the structures that can come closest to the structures of heaven or the structures of the ideal.
Well, I thought that in Platonism, at least one interpretation is that the phenomenal world is a projection of the world of ideas. And so there's a connection there, and it's not just an illusion.
Yeah, I don't think it's an illusion. I also don't think he's not saying it's an illusion. That's why I agree that it is a projection. So there is a real that is being projected. But the projection is a distortion. It is not the perfect real. That's why he thinks of the cosmos as a bad copy of the perfect world. In that sense, it is a projection, but it's not it's a distortion at the same time. But it's not an illusion, you're right. And so, can it be perfected and brought back to that which is projecting it? There's a question mark there. I don't think he says yes. He does say individuals can arrive at some intimations, intuitions, and maybe even experiences of that reality. But at the cosmic level, we have to escape from the distorted projection. Not an illusion, but still a distortion.
Perhaps evolution is the missing ingredient there in being able to perfect the projections of the ideals, of the ideas, the true ideas.
Did you say evolution, John Robert?
Yes. Yes, evolution.
Yeah. So the philosophical idea of evolution, whether we can move from what we are to something perfect, I don't know to what extent. I doubt it's present in Plato. You know, of course, with Aristotle, we have a sense that there is a closer connection between the world of ideas and the world of nature. You know, there's less of a sense of distortion in his work. But more contemporary philosophers have brought in this notion of evolution and also have inverted the notion of a bad copy of the ideal world. Say, for example, with Deleuze, the world of ideas is imminent in the cosmos. And this, you know, variety that we see that he's talking about here is due to the various manifestations of these ideas, which are problems to be solved. And evolution is the way by which those problems are being solved. So that gives it, it sort of stands this idea on its head, as it were, making the imminent power of truth into the guiding force for moving towards something perfect. But if we look at it either as a fall, a derivative from a higher truth, which will always remain like that, or as a illusion, which has no connection with the truth, then we can't affirm any reality to the cosmos and have to try to escape from it into something else.
So it sounds like from what you're saying that there's, we could say there's a convergence in the Western, in, at least in certain Western traditions, with this recreation or regeneration of Eastern traditions that Sri Aurobindo is doing, and by bringing in the notion of evolution.
Yeah, completely. I completely agree. That's a profound point. Yes, this is happening. It even starts from thinkers like Heidegger, who are going back to the pre-Socratics, who in a sense maybe thought of as similar to the Upanishadic thinkers, and trying to affirm the becoming rather than pitch of original being and derive a kind of a faulty becoming, a kind of like a sort of always, a kind of mired becoming in its place. So that is happening. A number of thinkers have tried to do that in the Western tradition as well.
Thank you.
There's some interesting, I'm actually, I don't know, I'd recommend to any of you who might be interested, Richard Hartz's book called The Clasp of Civilizations. I think it may be available on Amazon. I'm reading it for reviewing it at this point. And The Clasp of Civilizations. And in one of its last chapters, he traces this Platonic idea that I just spoke about to giant transmissions. There are some thinkers who've actually traced very close parallels between illusionism. Again, note that Mayavadin is not only Advaita Vedanta phenomenon. Buddhism is a kind of Mayavada, Theravada Buddhism, and Jainism is also a kind of Mayavada. So this, some thinkers have traced very close linkages between Jainism and Platonism and tried to show how there was a transmission from Jain philosophy to Platonism at that stage in Greek thought, which may be true, but I'm not sure. But it's an interesting speculation.
What was Richard's last name?
Harz, H-A-R-T-Z. The clasp of civilizations.
I think it's the same Harz from which we get the unit of frequency, Harz.
No, that is H-E-R-T-Z.
Okay,
H-E-R-T-Z. H-E-R-T-Z.
Is this Richard Harz from the archives?
Yes.
So, shall we stop here and continue next time?
Sure, I think it's time.
Yeah. So next time, Devashish will be in Northern California itself, right?
Yeah, I'll probably be at Shyam's place.
Okay, so that will be the August 13th, I suppose.
Will be right around the time of Sri Aurobindo's birthday.
Perfect. Okay.
In fact, the next day I'll be at CIF giving the Sri Aurobindo lecture.
Sure. Beautiful, Devasita. Sure. So we'll stop now and continue on August 13th.